You are listening to the Evolve Your Intimacy podcast with Dr. Stephanie, where it is my goal to educate, enlighten, and evolve your intimacy. You can find me at evolveyourintimacy.com to learn more about counseling, self-study courses, sex, and the retreats that we have to offer. This show contains discussions about relationships, intimacy, and sex, and is meant for those who are 18 years and older. Now, sit back, relax, listen up, and get ready to evolve your intimacy. Were you told that you needed to save yourself for marriage? Were you part of that purity culture, and maybe you have some religious and maybe some sexual trauma and shame because of that? Today on our show, how to heal and thrive after religious and sexual trauma and survive in the purity culture, we're going to have some really insightful conversations about experiencing religious sexual trauma and navigating those effects of the purity culture. Through sharing these personal stories and some professional insights and, of course, practical strategies, I aim to empower you and to provide you with the tools necessary to heal and reclaim your sexuality, as well as cultivate a fulfilling life beyond the trauma. So join us on this transformational journey of healing and thriving as we navigate the complexities of religious sexual trauma and the purity culture. Stay tuned. Before we get started, let me tell you about the Top Waterproof Blanket, which now comes in four reversible colors, because no one wants to sleep in the wet spot and squirt is hot until it's not. So if you're fed up with sleeping in the wet spot or having to change your sheets every time you have sex, then you need the Top Waterproof Blanket. It's 100% waterproof and leak-proof, and it guarantees to keep your bed and mattress dry no matter how wet it gets. From messy massage oils, silicone lubes, and all sorts of sexy wetness, just throw it in the washer and dryer and it comes out looking brand new. And you don't have to worry about leaving your house to get one. Simply go to Amazon and search for Top Waterproof Blanket. That's T-O-P Waterproof Blanket, and order yours today. Great sex starts now. You are listening to the Evolve Your Intimacy podcast, and I'm Dr. Stephanie. Now, let's get back to the show.
All right. So today I have the pleasure of having Dr. Tina with me. And Dr. Tina, there are so many great things that you have researched and that you are passionate about when it comes to clinical sex therapy. And just kind of introduce yourself to my listeners and tell us a little bit about you and, you know, what your interests and your passions are and what your specialty is.
Yeah. So great to be here with you, Stephanie. So let's see. I have had a very circuitous career. I started out as a high and high school teacher. And from there, when I learned from kids, I ended up in a marriage and family therapy program and got my first graduate degree and taught in an accredited marriage and family therapy program for 28 years as an associate professor. One of the courses that I taught was the human sexuality course, which is required for licensure in the state of Washington. But while I was teaching that class from the early 90s on, I was also in medicine, training physicians. I had a clinical appointment at the University of Washington. I ran a medical family therapy program, which placed MFTs in outpatient clinical medical settings. And that was kind of my deal. But meanwhile, I'm over here also teaching this human sexuality course. And I would have my students write their sexual autobiography. And most of the time when people hear that, they're like, oh my gosh, I can't imagine committing that to paper. But if you're going to be a therapist, you're only ever as good a therapist as you know what your stories are, right? Where you begin and end and your clients begin and end. So I would say, if you grew up in the United States, chances are your sexual story isn't a narrative. It's a series of events that you remember, but they're not really storied together. Like you remember getting in trouble when you were playing doctor, or you remember your first kiss, or you remember, but I want you to see it as an arc. I want you to see what the influences were on that story. I want you to see what the legacy is and whether you want that legacy to continue in your own life, et cetera. So I would give them like 80 questions. And I'd say, I don't want you to answer every one, but I want you to see the answer that I'm asking of you. And then I want you to write it. And they would be anywhere from 15 to 30 pages long. And people would often tell me it was the most important paper that they wrote in grad school. And one program, they would write about 300 papers. So that was pretty significant. Around the year 2000, I started to notice a dramatic shift in the tone of these papers. They began to include so much more of a lack of awareness of what normative sexual development over time ought to be. And out of that was all this self-condemnation and self-hatred about what they had done, what they hadn't done, what they'd wanted, what they didn't want, what they did, just all kinds of things. And I couldn't figure out what I was seeing at first. It took me about 3 years of just asking more questions and sitting and hanging out and talking to the students more and listening to clients. And what I began to notice is I was hitting the first wave of people who had been affected by abstinence-only education across the United States and the purity movement in conservative religious environments or communities around the country. And the symptomology of some of my students and clients looked exactly like somebody who had experienced childhood sexual abuse. And so after seeing this over and over again, I started to say, I want to understand this more. I want to do research on this. I'm going to go back and get my PhD. I want to really understand what's happening here. And out of that, 11 years later, 11 years after I started writing it, I published a book on it. I wrote an article in 2006 before I started the book, and it was called Christians Caught Between the Sheets on how an abstinence-only ideology hurts us. And all I did was tell stories of what I'd been hearing and what I was thinking and referenced a very few number of people around the country in different ethical departments and religious ethical departments who were talking about this too. And that article ended up going viral. Like I literally heard from people in other countries.
Awesome.
So it was published in an open journal, and I thought, okay, I've hit a nerve. People aren't talking about this like I am, and that I need to do more work here. And so that's what led me into getting my PhD and then really researching this. What is sexual shame? Do we know what sexual shame is? At that point, we didn't even have an operational definition of sexual shame. That took till 2017, right after my book was published, actually. We had definitions of shame, thanks to the work of Brené Brown and others, but we didn't have about what is sexual shame, right? So that ended up becoming my sort of new focus in my career was on sexual shame, the impact of sexual shame, the role of religious sexual shame and trauma, the impact of the purity movement, also what was the arc of what had happened in the United States that played a role in this, and then what are we really always meant to have a sex negative kind of background? I mean, was that always meant to be? So I did some research into other ideas that were on the Abrahamic line. I mean, I knew stuff that was on the Eastern lines, but I didn't know anything else, and I found some beautiful sex positive things that were just never brought forward. And so yeah, that kind of ended up being what happened. It kind of took me along on a ride. And it felt really important now that, you know, we can see, they're saying as many as 1 in 5 people in the United States have religious sexual shame or religious sexual trauma. That's 20% of our population. It is now crowding into so many therapist offices and the PT, public board PT offices and OBGYN offices and urology offices. And we didn't know then what we're seeing now at the amount that we're seeing now. So
let's just remind everyone that this is Evolve Your Intimacy, and I am Dr. Stephanie from Evolve Your Intimacy. We are having an amazing discussion, but we need to take a quick break, so stay right there and we'll be right back. You are listening to the Evolve Your Intimacy podcast, and I'm Dr. Stephanie. Now, let's get back to the show.
It's so cool that we kind of mirror each other. I was a middle school, high school teacher that led into this, that led into that. And then on the purity culture side, I am the, from East Texas, I am exactly what the abstinence movement purity culture is, because in Texas, we can't teach sex education. We can only teach sex abstinence in public schools. And then, of course, I was, you know, I've said this many times on the show before that the I have a very hard time masturbating now, because when I got caught or whatever masturbating when I was growing up, I had to go to a church and I had to sit down and go through anti-masturbation classes, and I was shamed for it because I touched myself. And so I never touched myself again after that, because I didn't want to go back to that class at church.
Of course. Oh, you poor thing. That's traumatizing. Yeah. It's traumatizing and obviously so shameful, because pleasure and connection and comfort, which is what children are doing when they're touching themselves, it's really about comfort and pleasure, right? That's as natural as breathing and speaking.
Yeah.
Just so natural. And so you shame a child for being who they are, and it hurts them way down deep inside.
It does. It does. And yeah, that is, it's so exciting. There's one other person that I know who's a really good friend of mine who came through the school with me. Her name is Danielle, and Danielle is hitting on the sexual shame of the purity culture and stuff. And so I love that. And I love how just you are just like, no, that we've got to make these changes, because it is such a horrible stigma to live under, because I've lived under it my entire life. I guess, you know, I didn't realize how bad it was.
Exactly.
But I am that person, being from a small southern town who had to go to church every Sunday and Wednesday and, you know, just all of that stuff.
Right, exactly. There was a PhD student at Seattle Pacific University who wanted to take on religious sexual shame, but got into the literature and found out there wasn't even an operational definition of sexual shame. So she's like, okay, I got to go there first, because we have to build on that. And so she interviewed people with a variety of backgrounds. I think there were only two, maybe three of the people she interviewed out of like at least 15 that were from a religious background. The vast majority were not. Right. And out of her qualitative research came the first operational definition. And I'm happy to share it with you and your listeners, because it's shocking what it says. But it's even more shocking to me when you think that this came from a group that the majority were just influenced by American culture, not the additional layer of all the church stuff, you know, that was going on at the time. It's fascinating, and I included it in, it's not in the paperback or hard copy of the book, but it is in the Audible version of the book, because I wanted people to hear it, because it's so powerful. It says sexual shame is a visceral feeling. So in our bodies, a visceral feeling of humiliation and disgust toward one's own body and identity as a sexual being, and a belief of being abnormal, inferior, and unworthy. This feeling can be internalized, but it also manifests in interpersonal relationships. So like that very first time we get in trouble for touching ourselves, which is usually pre-verbal. We're usually 10, 11, 12 months old, right? We're getting our diapers changed. We now know how to move our hands, and our hand finds its way to our genitals, and that's a great day for us. But not for a caregiver, right? Who usually loses their mind in some way, slaps their hand away, whatever, right? So it happens in interpersonal relationships over and over, having a negative impact, get this, on trust, communication, and physical and emotional intimacy. So those are big areas to hurt somebody in, right? Sexual shame develops across the lifespan in interactions with interpersonal relationships, like I just said, one's culture and society. Now, this is key, I think, because we know from research that 6-year-olds, 50% of 6-year-old girls are modifying their diet already. 2/3 of 9-year-olds, 90% of 15-year-olds. So they've already gotten the message from culture that they're not okay.
Yeah.
Right? So culture and society and a subsequent critical self-appraisal, the internal feedback loop gets going, right? We hear it on the inside. We hear it outside of us. We hear it on the inside and just goes over and over and over, and it cements itself, right? There's also a fear and uncertainty related to one's power or right to make decisions, including safety decisions related to sexual encounters, along with an internalized judgment towards one's own sexual desire. So I don't know if you've read Peggy Ornstein's book, Girls and Sex.
No.
She also has another one called Boys and Sex. She's a New York Times. Oh, they are still worth reading. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She interviewed with Girls and Sex. She interviewed about 80 girls, 15 to 22. In the boys' book, I think it was 200 between those age ranges. But in the girls' book, she learns, one of the things she learns is that many, many young women are feeling confident in every area of their life, studies, friends, you know, just where they want to go, their dreams, you know, career, whatever, until they get ready to go out. And then they're putting down 3, 4, and 5 shots of hard liquor because they don't know these two things that their definition point out. They don't know if they can keep themselves safe or if they have the right to, right? This is how prevalent sexual shame is in just our general race culture. And then you add a whole other layer on top of it for those that are exposed to conservative church settings where somebody is abusing power by seeking for God, right? And saying, God also feels this about you and doesn't want this, you know, whatever. So this is deep. It's pre-verbal. It's over and over and over again on abuses of power or inside of it for lots of people. So we find in our offices when we're working with people that they're having to do so much work to heal this, to believe that they're worthy of love and belonging and joy and pleasure and fun and connection. You know, it's like, those are all very hard things to do work around because they have so much fear and so much inside hurt around it.
Oh my gosh, that is so true. I feel like speaking directly to me on all of this, because when you said, you know, we don't even know if we have the right to say no or the right to protect ourselves, that's critical in our safety, in our emotional, physical, just sexual safety, but just in our development. What are we just supposed to give people all of this stuff? Are we supposed to claim it for ourselves? And it's a question that so many young girls, I mean, I have a 17-year-old daughter and I don't ever want her to feel this way. I want her to feel that she never has to say or do things that she doesn't want to say or do. And so I have a question. What is the impact of sexual shame, like on our body image, in our relational and our sexual health? Like how can we heal from all of that?
Yeah. So as we go for the definition, and as you and I see in our offices, the effect is powerful. It's effect. I've often said, I don't know how you hurt someone more than what we do through sexual shame, because they are afraid that they're so unworthy and so they have so many deficits, right? They're so, I don't know what the word is I want, but just, you know, that they have a hard time both giving and receiving love from an authentic, transparent place. Yeah. So somebody comes to offer them love, they want it, right? But they have put on a mask to be like, I'll pretend to be this person and you'll love this person because this person's good enough. And so when they're given love, they think to themselves, well, they're not really loving me, because if they knew me, if they knew how bad and dirty and perverted and whatever I am, they couldn't possibly love me. And so it impacts their ability to receive love. It impacts their ability to give love because they're behind a mask of trying to be good enough, even though they were good enough the minute they were born. They were good enough all along the way, right? But they don't believe that because of the amount of messaging that they were thought that has said otherwise to them. Yeah. And so healing sexual shame is a big task. You know, I'm often like, you didn't get this overnight. It's not going to go away overnight, you know? And so there, in the book, In Sex, God, and the Conservative Church, that book, I talk about a model for healing sexual shame. And the model came out of working with people for years and years and years, all the years that I was writing the book. And I call it Healing the Mess, the model for erasing sexual shame. So the model is four components. I call it frame, name, claim, and aim. So frame is get yourself the scaffolding of sex education. So much of what you got from media, you got from friends, you got from our culture actually has not been true. It has not been based in reality. It has not been based in research. It's not accurate at all. And you deserve accurate information about how magnificent you are and how magnificent your body is. And so start reading. And I wrote a book for parents and people who wanted to get clear about what they did and didn't get growing up. And I divided that into two year increments. I both to two to four, 4 to 6, up to 18. And it's called Shameless Parenting, but it's really for anybody that has kids, knows kids, works with kids, works with teenagers, or themselves wants to know what does growing up healthy actually look like. This book really lays it out. And at the end of every chapter, it has, here's the top books and websites right now for your kids or for the younger people in your life and for you. And I recommend those all the way through, you know. But when we've got, when we're trying to heal our sexual shame, the first thing we've got to do really is dispel the mythology that we've gathered from growing up. And input in their real knowledge, because knowledge is power, right? And so here's some ways to get, here's a bunch of books, here's a bunch of websites, here's how you get the real stuff. From there, claim. Claim is learning to claim your body as good. We live in a country that literally propels its economy based on you feeling badly about yourself.
Yes. Right?
How you look. How you smell, what you do, what you own, what you don't own, everything, right? And the worse we feel and the more resources we have, the more we spend, the more we propel the economy, right? That's a horrible way for a society to propel its economy, but it's what the United States does, and it's gotten worse in its privileging of capitalistic ways of thinking over humanitarian ways of thinking, human ways of thinking, right? Things that actually uplift people. And so I invite people to begin to see their body as good. If you get up in the morning and you're not in severe pain or something like that, it's a good day. You have a body that's like, thinking of your body like the pen that writes the poetry of your life. If you have a body, it's good. And it really, you know, if you look around the world, you will see different societies, different ethnicities whose bodies are different than yours. Your heredity much more determines your body shape than anything else. It's not what you're eating, what you're not eating, what you're exercising, what you're not. It's just, it's your DNA. That's the biggest player here. So if you are not in severe pain and you have a body, then great. You get to go out and love with that body. Do good things with that body. Have fun with that body. It's a good body. But that is so much easier said than done. We have to work really hard to undo all those years of messaging.
Yeah.
You know? Right? And so I'm often talking about, like, here's some really good books to read if you want to follow other people who've been doing the work of coming to claim their body and that kind of thing. Like, Your Body Is Not an Apology, by Sonia Renee Taylor is a fabulous book. Let's see if I can remember. There's a, I'll think of it. Adrienne Brown has a book from I think it's called Pleasure Activism, from a few years ago. That's another fabulous book on how to claim your body as good. That's the claim part. Yeah. And then after name or framing and claiming is naming, tell your story to someone who has empathy, compassion, who will likely say, yeah, me too, here's what happened to me. I want you to learn that you're not alone, that 90 to 95% of people in the U.S. today grew up in homes that were silent or silent and shaming around sexuality. So here we provided you information on a whole bunch of other stuff, but we didn't tell you about your body and how magnificent and cool and fabulous it is and how to take care of it, how to protect it, how to draw boundaries. I mean, all of it. We have failed to give you the very tools you need to know when you're being exploited, to know how to draw boundaries, to know that you have body autonomy, to know what consent is and isn't. I mean, so many things, media literacy. I mean, so many things we have failed to give people. But when you start to get that framing, get that sort of claiming of your body, get that telling your story, you start doing those things, what you'll notice, it's like unraveling a rubber band ball or something. You'll start to feel like, oh, I am designing a new, healthy legacy for me. And as I do that for me, then I'll be influencing the people in my life and the younger people in my life. And I can change that legacy in my lifetime. And it won't ever have to continue beyond me. That's what's exciting about doing this work, is that not only are you liberating yourself and opening up spaces for you to enjoy your life more, but you are changing the future too, right? So that's just, those are four kind of ideas to begin the journey of healing. And I'm like, work with therapists. There's so many great therapists and sex therapists, you know, people that are both, they're trained as a therapist, individual, couple, family therapist, but then they have a sex therapy on it too. And they're what, about 5% of therapists that have all of that training. And I'm like, go find yourself one of those. Yeah. And they will hold your hand all the way through.
Yes, yes. So we're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about, can spirituality and sexuality coexist? Has your soggy pickle left you disappointed during times of intimacy? Do you need help keeping your pickle hard? I've partnered with a company that understands the unique needs of those in the lifestyle and the shame and disappointment that accompanies a soggy pickle. So the next time you have the opportunity to toss a salad, make sure you have a rock-hard pickle. Choose your treatment today by going to shamelesscare.com. You can sign up for a subscription service or get a one-time order. Make sure that you use code EYI at checkout and get your $30 off your first order.
You are listening to the Evolve Your Intimacy podcast, and I'm Dr. Stephanie. Now, let's get back to the show.
So, Dr. Tina, before the break, I'd ask, can spirituality and sexuality coexist? And yeah, I mean, I know they can. And, you know, there's just some people who don't feel that way. And if they can, what are, is this erasing your mess model? Is that what we employ to be able to coexist with it?
Yeah, I talk about in one of the last chapters of the book what it looks like to begin to integrate sexuality and spirituality. Spirituality is a personal thing, right? So we have to find out from people, what does spirituality mean to you? What is it rooted in? What are the values of it? How do you practice it? You know, to understand it. But it's involved in deep meaning, something that's deeply meaningful to us usually, and some amount of mystery is often involved in it. And so I'm like, you know, find a way to come alongside a person's definition of it and then begin talking about what does it mean to enter into a space of mystery and meaning with your sexuality. So when we are intimate with ourselves, so I'll just start there. We're intimate with ourselves. We are in a space where our body, mind, spirit, emotions, our thinking are all involved. It's like a total involvement. And in those places, a lot of things that can happen that are mysterious, right? It's not uncommon for someone to orgasm and start to cry, right? Like, oh, it's bringing up feelings for me, right? It has a way of this body, mind, soul opening that can happen in an orgasmic release, right? And when we're sharing that with someone else and we are not up here in our heads with how am I performing, how am I looking, how am I whatever, but we're down in the experience with ourselves and with this other person, kind of lost in the experience, we also open up possibilities for mysterious experiences to happen, right? Where we're like, oh, I didn't feel entirely clear about why it began and ended and you began and ended. Like something mysterious happened in there. And the pleasure was so kind of overwhelming on some aspect that I feel like something other happened here between mm-hmm. us, right? These kinds of things can happen. They don't happen all the time, but they certainly can happen. And the more we learn to be present and out of our heads and into our experience, into the authenticity of our experience and the authenticity of our feelings, then we often have these really what we would call spiritual experiences. It was funny. I met when I was in grad school getting my PhD, I met a woman who did her research on the language people use globally when they're orgasming. And the most common phrase was a phrase like, oh God. And she thought that was very interesting. She was a Chinese woman and she just didn't expect to see that, to hear that. And I was thinking to myself, that's so fascinating, you know, that we still in that moment go to a place of mystery, right? And we say, wow, you know, oh, wow, in a mysterious place. And I think that's telling in some ways. One of the other things I've been doing lately is I have been studying for the last year the integration of psychotherapy, trauma, and psychedelics. So the role that psychedelics are going to play in the next decade as we move into them becoming legal. And psychedelics have a way of inviting people into the mysterious as well. A place where they find themselves experiencing things that get them to go, oh, well, love is real. Or I am connected to all things in the universe. Or I have ancestors that care about me deeply and are playing a role in my life for the positive. You know, they'll come out with these experiences they weren't expecting to have. And they're just, because the experiences are so deeply bodied, they are changed. And what we know from the early research is that there's neuroplasticity happening. The brain is actually moving to new perspectives as it has these experiences. And we are seeing, you know, one, two, or three treatment processes that include integration sessions and all the medicine sessions and the integration, but where people are not showing up with, you know, people who've been chronically high PTSD scores for their lifetime or their lifetime are showing up a year later without any PTSD. So this is going to be incredible, but it's also because these are indigenous medicines, yes. Many of them, they're deeply spiritual. And I think that there's going to be a place where we're going to be talking about the integration of sexuality, psychedelics, and healing interpersonal pain.
I can't wait for psychedelics to hit the mental health market, so to speak, because I agree. It is going to be life-changing for so many people who have just carried around the shame and guilt of just living and breathing instead of being able to actually thrive.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm most excited about too. And, you know, having worked with people for years around how deeply, I don't know, like covered in black tar they are from the sexual shame and how hard they're having to work to get it off, I'm seeing psychedelics as a possibility to really move people along faster, in very healthy ways, safe ways. And then they're freer sooner and can go live and do whatever good in the world they're wanting to do. They're going to be free to do it. And they're going to believe that they can and that they should. You know, with the shame keeps them from believing that they can or that they should. And they can and they should. But we need help to help free them so that they can.
So for the parents who are listening and who don't want to continue the cycle of shame, what are some of your best things for them, your best advice for them to do with this new generation of kids?
Yeah, that was the number one question that I kept getting from people everywhere. Was I experienced this shame growing up, the sexual shame, religious sexual shame. I don't want to do to my kids what was done to me, but I honestly have no idea what to do. So every time my kid does something, yeah, I just go, ah, I don't know what to do. And I'm like, I got you. I've been teaching physicians about this stuff for decades. I will write you a book and I will literally hold your hand all the way through it. All you have to do is be 2 years ahead of your kid. You don't even have to have it all figured out, not even close. And that's what shameless parenting, it's the whole title is shameless parenting, everything you need to raise shame-free, confident kids and heal your shame too. Because we are limited by our shame. So we have to do our work, right? And so I'm like, first to two, read that, know that, get those books, you know, become familiar with all the resources that I've told you, and then go 2 to 4 so you're just a little bit ahead, right? Yeah. 2 years ahead. Read, get, whatever. And then just keep the books around the house, pick them up, read them. As they're older, they're going to pick them up and read them. And then you don't want to think about a sex talk. That's bogus. You want to think about 100 or 1,000 one-minute conversations that happen every year, right? You're looking for opportunities to talk about what kindness is, what good friendships are, what a good relationship is, what taking advantage of, what power differentials and taking advantage people look like, what it feels like on the giving and the receiving end, body autonomy, like so many things you want to be talking about. And every year they get a little bit more sophisticated and your conversations just get a little bit more sophisticated. And they happen all the time. There's one of my favorite books, which is a research-based book. So it's a book that I recommend for parents. It's called Not Under My Roof, and it's written by Amy Shallett. And I think I mentioned this maybe in the 10 to 12 section of the Shameless Parenting book. Amy's book, Amy grew up in Holland. She came to the United States to do studies and started noticing that adolescent kids were really different around sexuality and their relationship with their parents than in Holland. Holland has one of the best comprehensive sex education programs in the world. That pre-K runs every single year all the way through they graduate, right? And that's similar in Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Iceland, right? All of the Nordic countries have been doing this for decades. And the STI rates are on the floor. They hardly have any. Teen pregnancy rates super low. People get in egalitarian, happy relationships. Very little rape and abuse in those countries. It's much, much lower than here. Like here, we are so high. And it's just fascinating to me. So when Amy wrote her book, she decided she was going to do a qualitative study. She took 2 towns in Holland that were like rural city, 2 towns in the United States, rural city, and then interviewed families that had teenagers, interviewed the parents and interviewed the kids, and then did a qualitative research study looking at how were they similar and different. And then she, which was a gift to all of us, she took her work and put it into a really good book.
Okay.
Not Under My Roof. And so if you want to see, if, you know, there are people out there I know who think to themselves, if I tell my kids about sexuality, they're just going to go do it.
No.
Research has forever shown that not to be true. In fact, kids delay sexual onset, right? And they get involved with much better people when they do decide to get involved with somebody, yeah, right? Well, you can see in this book, it's in black and white, as she compare and contrast these families. Kids in Holland and the Nordic countries, they're often talking to their parents about whether the parents think they're ready to be more involved with somebody or not. Like they are talking all the way through because the kids have learned to trust that their parents actually know something and are totally open and non-condemning, non-shaming about sexuality and understand sexual development, like how it's going to unfold. They talk to their parents, you know? So because they've been doing this now since the 30s. I mean, a lot of generations later. This is epigenetic at this point. We are so far from that. Like you were saying, you know, in Texas, they're still teaching abstinence-only education, even though we know from research that 80% of abstinence education is medically inaccurate. Medically inaccurate. So actually setting up kids to be exploited, to be assaulted, to not know boundaries, to not know how to protect themselves, to not know what they want, what they don't want, how to speak it, how not, all of it. We are throwing them to the wolves of our media system, mm-hmm. which is incredibly dangerous, right? Yeah. I mean, we have kids, we have boys. I think the figure is something like 90% or over 90% of boys doing video games, many of which are about being violent towards women. And for those kids who are straight, you know, that and pornography, where priest pornography is a lot about violence against women, how in the heck are they supposed to know how you actually treat somebody, treat a woman?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I know I'm being heteronormative here, but really that's one of the places where I see the most assault, the most lack of happiness in relationships. It's with those people who are heterosexual. A lot of the people who are trans, non-binary, gay, lesbian, whatever, they are working out their relationships with each other. They are talking to each other. They are learning boundaries, knowing boundaries. The kink community is one of the most advanced communities we have out there around how to talk about, how to negotiate, how to listen, how to honor. The vanilla community, forget it.
I know.
They're terrible.
I know. I always make the comment, if everybody could have the communication skills of those in alternative relationships, the world would be so happy. But, you know, we're not taught that. It took years and years.
It would. It's so much. No.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we have so much less assault. So much less assault than we have, mm-hmm. which is just heartbreaking, because I know in a lot of the research that they're doing right now in PTSD and psychedelics, you know, they'll talk about working with veterans, and that is super important work. I'm grateful for that work. But 68% of the PTSD that is seen and worked with is from sexual assault. It's a huge number in our culture.
Yeah.
And it's because we teach
it. I get it.
Literally.
When we are talking about the family and we are talking about improving family functioning, when it comes to communication about sex, communication about life, communication in general, because we don't, in America, we don't communicate well with our family. It's just, oh, they're expected to know. How can we improve this family functioning through the lens of sexual communication and sexual honesty?
That's a huge question. But I do think that becoming comfortable with the sex education, or what sexual development looks like in a 2-year-old, 4-year-old, 6-year-old, 8-year-old, 10-year-old, like becoming aware of and comfortable in and able to talk about it, which means dealing with some of your own shame. And that's part of what's in the shameless parenting. I'm saying if you're hearing this stuff, that this is what your kid might do in this 2-year span, and it's making you uncomfortable, that's just your indicator that you were raised in such a way that you were shamed around this very normal part of you. And here are some questions to consider. And so I invite people through a series of questions that will help them become clear where their shame is and what it's about and what they're feeling. And then how do you begin healing that and solving that for yourself? You know, and often I ask the question, if you imagine that your parents had done for you what you are looking right now to do for your kiddo, how might life have been different for you just in these 2 years? Mm-hmm. Right. And so they begin to imagine what it could have been like, which starts that healing process to happen. Right. Yes. Doing that around these subjects that we so often silence, actually what it does underneath it all with your kid is it helps your kid to trust you. It's like, if my parent can talk about these hard things, you know, in a totally open, easy, non-judgmental kind of way, openly curious kind of way, then I can trust them with other things too. That's what they learn. They learn that over and over and over again. So then what happens is kids actually do keep coming to their parents, mm-hmm. right? And the research shows this. Research shows that parents who were involved in having many sexual health and relational health, life health conversations as they were growing up, those kids, when asked, describe themselves as closer to their parents overall. Mm-hmm. And this includes adolescents. So I'll say to parents, if you really want to have a good relationship with your kid all the way through adolescence, then focus on being a good sex educator.
Yes.
You know, do the things in this shameless book and your kid is going to trust you. They're going to just want to tell you. And believe me, society is changing fast enough that what you experienced in your adolescence, some things your kid is going to experience that you were never exposed
yes.
to. That some things are going to be similar, but there are a lot of things that are different. And most parents have no idea the war zone that their child is going into every single day that they go to school. Every day.
I say this all the time.
And so to lose touch with your child is really dangerous, I think.
Yes. And I say all the time, we were not raised.
Yeah, say more.
We were not raised for the world that we're raising our children for. So what we thought healthy, normal, whatever, is so far-fetched now because the world we're raising our children for, we've never even seen. And so the parents who beat themselves up because they don't do something well enough or they're messing up in this area, I feel you, but we aren't. We've never lived in this world before, so it's unrealistic to place those expectations on ourselves. But I agree with you. If we are starting those healthy, those wholesome, healthy sexual conversations in general, having our children come to us and be able to say, hey, mom, I had a really bad day today. Can we talk about it? Instead of bottling it up and then going and shooting up a school or bottling it up and going and doing self-harm, being able to come to you and say, I need to talk. That is more powerful and more liberating for a child than us actually knowing what we're supposed to be raising them for. Like if we knew the future, we don't know, but we have to cultivate those relationships now.
Yeah, there's so much wisdom in what you're saying. And so I think the big question around what you're saying is how? How do we foster an environment such that our child will want to come to us? But we have to constantly be putting ourselves in our child's shoes. What makes me safe to come talk to? What makes them know that I'm not going to get mad, I'm not going to shame them, I'm going to be really clear, like, it's your job description to do this or do that or think this or think that. I'm not going to take those things personally. Like, you can be mad at me. Not going to take it personally because, of course, you're trying to become an independent person. You're not going to think I'm great all the time. It's okay. But we have to show them every single day that we can handle them and handle their world, which means we work really, really hard to be non-reactive. We know how to self-soothe. We know how to keep our mouth closed until we can speak with openness, respect, curiosity, and accountability to the amount of power that I have over my child, right? I'm going to practice those things because having a safe environment is so important to their health and well-being so that they know they can come talk to me. But we have to do it, like literally work on it every day. And when we blow it, because we're going to blow it, we go to them and we say, you know what? I really overreacted right there. I take full responsibility for that. I should not have done that. What I needed to do was this. I didn't. I'm so sorry if that hurt or scared you or made you not want to come talk to me because that's the last thing I want. I'd love for you to think about what else I can do to make that up to you. So we work to repair the relationship.
I feel 100% seen right now that you just said that. I have always really tried to repair things with my daughter, and I am a hot mess. Anybody who's been listening to this podcast knows that. Everybody knows that I try my damnedest to be something and everybody's someone, but I'm going to fall short, and I know that. And unfortunately, when I fall short, sometimes my daughter catches the brunt of that because she's just my person. And I can't tell you over the years how many times I've sat down with her and said, you know what? I am so sorry that I lost my temper, or I am so sorry that I said that. I take full responsibility. And my mom saw me doing that. And she was like, why are you doing that? Why are you taking responsibility? I said, because if I don't take responsibility for my behavior, how is she going to know to take responsibility for hers? That was such a foreign concept for my mom. And that reflects in how I was raised. Like, she never takes responsibility for her actions. And so for her to see me do it, she thought I was just insane.
Yeah, but how liberating for your daughter. And what a brilliant model for her. So she's like, oh, I'm not responsible for what my mom chose to do. I am responsible for what I choose to do. I also don't have to take responsibility for what other people do. Like, she's so much clearer about where she begins and ends, and other people begin and end. And if somebody tries to put it on her, she'd be like, no, that was you. That was you. And it's not me. That was your, but you said and you did. You're responsible. I'm not responsible for that, for those choices. I'm just not, but I am responsible for the ones that come out of me.
And that is such a foreign concept for parents.
It's also a beautiful modeling of how to repent. It is. But you want to gain your child's respect? Let them see you do that. And you will gain your child's respect. And it's beautiful modeling for them. And they will do better in their significant relationship because you've done that. They will know how to repair. They will know how to own. They will know nobody dies when you own your mistake, that you can learn. I used to say to my kids, we've got four of them and they're all grown now, but I remember saying, there is no such thing as a mistake, only if you don't learn from it.
Yeah.
If you don't learn from it, you can turn it into a mistake because you'll probably do it again.
Sure.
But if you make a mistake and you sit down and sort of do a postmortem on it, you know, like, well, what could I have done different? What might I do different next time? It's a learning. If we weren't meant to learn from our mistakes, then this thing called the prefrontal lobe, it would cook a whole lot faster than 28. Right? So we are meant to learn from our mistakes. We are not bad for making mistakes. We are invited to learn something from them and then continue to make our lives better.
I thank you for sharing that. That is just, I think everybody needs to hear that. And everybody who's a parent needs to know that you're going to mess up and it's okay. But the way you rectify that is by taking ownership of your fuck up and saying, I apologize.
That's right. That's right. And do like what you were explaining. You know, you said, this is what I did. And I own that I made that choice in that moment and that it was wrong. And how I wish I would have handled it is this. This is what I'm going to work to do different next time so that they can see you're really invested in it, you know, and then is there anything I can do to repair this with you or, you know, make this, bring some restitution to this because I know I hurt you and I'm really sorry for that because that's not my intent. So, but I know it was the consequence or the effect of my behavior. You know, we just show them that we can handle how to gracefully handle our errors, which models for them that they can do the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's beautiful when we do that with
our kids.
And
then that also reflects into their sexual communication, their sexual well-being, and then not allowing other people to run over them sexually if they have those boundaries of, no, that's you. I don't have to do this for you. It just is this full circle, full beautiful moment that no one explained to us, no one taught us growing up. And for you and I, we had to go and get doctorate degrees to figure this crap out. And it's just like, you know, people shouldn't have to have that sort of degree to really determine or to understand how to be human.
No. Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, I did have I've had a lot that was goofy about my family growing up, and there are a lot of skeletons in the closet for sure, like many families. But my family was a Swedish immigrant family. And the one huge gift that they gave me is that they were comfortable with their bodies and they were comfortable talking about sex and sexuality. So I never got a talk. And I could be telling you about my father, my mother, my grandparents, my great aunts, I mean, literally my uncle, but literally, and all of the key members of my family were this way. And I was naive enough to think every family was had to be kind of like mine until I was literally 30 years old and teaching sexuality, and then starting to just even notice in the first few sexual autobiographies that I read that, oh no, these families were really different than mine. But my heart broke when they started to hate themselves and not know that they were perfectly normal or in that scheme of what's common to experience in life. They had that, and nobody told them that. And they were condemning themselves at such profound level, you know? And I thought, when you grow up with just even that one thing, just somebody telling you you're good and your body is good and the urges of your body are good. And yes, you might have to learn to manage them, but they themselves are good, you know? Mm-hmm. It puts you in a different place with regard to who you are in relationship to your own body and in relationship to other people's bodies, you know, it puts you in a different place. And I thought, oh, people, there's a lot in my family that I wouldn't put on anybody's family.
I get you.
But that piece, I would give anything for families to know how to function that way, because it makes such a difference.
That is so true. So true. Well, I am just so impressed by your personality and your work and just you as a human. And I appreciate you taking some time to spend with us today. Can you tell my listeners where they can find you and all of your great books?
Sure, absolutely. So the books can be found at most booksellers, definitely on Amazon, although I know not everybody wants to go there. And if they have any trouble, they're always welcome to reach out to me. You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Tina Shameless. That's where I am on Instagram. I also run an institute that trains therapists, physicians, clergy, teachers in sexual health and understanding your sexual bias. And for those people that do want to get ASEX certified, we are an ASEX provider. We help people do that. And we do that very expediently. And because I would give anything to have every therapist and every physician out there actually certified, you know, in sexual health, sexual wellness, and understanding their sexual biases. So we do that. And if you want to follow that Instagram, the institute is called the Northwest Institute on Intimacy. And our Instagram is NW Institute on Intimacy. And then I have a website called TinaShermerSellers.com. So my first name. And then I am about to launch a brand new organization for psychedelic providers. So for medical prescribers and for therapists who've been trained, I'm creating a safe container, a supportive container for those people. And in the work, we will be paying out reparations to Indigenous organizations. We will be developing a scholarship fund so that these medicines, when they're legal, can be made available to people who actually need them. Because right now the costs are going to be anywhere from probably $4,000 to $20,000. And insurance isn't going to cover it. And so we want to try to make a scholarship foundation or scholarship fund that will help with that. So if you want to look at that and follow that, and if you are somebody who's becoming trained or just want to know, I mean, eventually we'll have a ton of providers on there from around the country. That is Inanna Rising, so INANNARISING.org. And that's really the place that I'm going to be cultivating a lot of health and wellness in my future, probably.
I love that. And I can't wait to, as soon as it's, you know, legal in Texas, I plan on fully getting certified and becoming part of that organization with you. So I am so excited that our paths crossed. So, and everything that she just told you will be linked in our show notes. So you can definitely take a look at that and find her. And if always you have any questions, you can hit me up and I will provide your information, provide her information to you. So you can always look it up that way. But today has been a very just passionate, deep conversation about how you can be better overall, but it's so hard to put this in just one simple term, but how you can better communicate and better parent, as well as love yourself. It's just this whole encompassing umbrella of self-love and self-appreciation that Dr. Tina is filling the gap for. And I'm so thankful for you and all of your hard work, because I know it's been hard work. And I thank you that you have the tenacity to get in there and stick with the fight.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephanie. It's been a joy to be with you today. And I love meeting a fellow person whose heart is with mine and my heart is with them. So thank you so much for this time.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy day to listen to my show. I am Dr. Stephanie with Evolve Your Intimacy. And remember, you are not in this alone, and we are definitely here to help. You can learn more about all the amazing things that we do at evolveyourintimacy.com. And if you subscribe to our newsletter, you'll receive free resources monthly to help you evolve your intimacy. Thank you again, and have a great night.